The United States was a bit of a sociological marvel because of the mass movement of peoples from around the world to a new land, a land that was open and a land that seemed to have opportunity. And so you had a movement that history doesn't normally allow. You had Germans and Italians, and you had Irish and Scottish. And I mean, just go through all the Russian and, I mean, all the different ethnic groups, certainly the Chinese, and on it goes. The United States became, and as history calls it, a great melting pot. The concept of coming in meant that every group that came in with their own distinctives. You would have known a German settlement. I mean, they spoke their own language, they had their own traditions, their clothes, their architecture, the way they farmed, the way they did everything was uniquely German for a while. And then bit by bit, the Germans began to melt in with their neighbors. Well, you just duplicate that with every single group. The concept of melting in took place over and over again, and so with the exception of a few of you whose family met the ships here, everybody else, and even your families, have bit by bit become like one another. Why did people melt? Why did they become that? Well, you could play 100 stories of different kinds of stories, but you can imagine why they melted. There would have been the German girl who was embarrassed at the way her family dress was. And she felt so plain, or she felt so this or that, embarrassed by what her family had her wear. But she really envied those Italian girls because they looked so feminine and they looked so this. And so she just bit by bit began to hide what she was wearing from her mother, but bit by bit began to dress more like the Italian girls because she admired. And there's the Italian boy, and I'm not trying to necessarily go with stereotypes on this, but the Italian boy who saw that Protestant girl, and she's from Germany or wherever it may be, and he became embarrassed at his loud, boisterous Catholic family background because he doesn't think included in that Protestant family, and he really likes that girl, so bit by bit he begins to water down and change some of the cultural things that came out of his Italian background so he's more acceptable to that group. You'd have the Irish, who for the most part came in very, very poor, and the Irish in particular. The guy is going, I'm not going to spend my whole life as a nobody. That Englishman at the top of the hill has money. And that Englishman at the top of the hill has the life I want for my kids and grandkids. And he bit by bit stopped being Irish so I can own the top of a hill like that. And so you'd have just lots and lots of those stories. And they melted together. In fact, you look around this room, about everybody's background would be pretty much at one point in time distinctive, but no longer such. We've melted together. It's not hard to melt together people who have the basic same goals in their life. If within your heart, in your life, you basically desire, I'd like my life to be better, I'd like to own something, I'd like to be able to achieve something that's more stable, I'd like to have a little more comfort, I'd like to gain respect. Almost all the immigrants had the same goals. Well, if you have the same goals, you won't let your distinctives and your strange cultures get in the way very long before you begin to just melt together. Now, don't ever think that melting was ever complete. No, the Germans still at holidays would be sure. I mean, it's just not a holiday if Grandma doesn't fix the sausage that way, and the Czechs and their sweet bread, or the English and their scones. I mean, so they kept a hold of some of their distinctives because some of their distinctives gave them comfort. But bit by bit, even with the distinctives, we melted together. That introduction, if you can picture some of that, must have been the experience of the people of God when they moved into the Promised Land. They come out of Egypt. They've been slaves in Egypt. They are nobodies. And God takes them out in the wilderness, and he looks after them. He makes them a distinctive people. He raises them up and said, you are my own people. You are not like any other people on the face of the earth. You are a kingdom of priests to me. And they were off in the wilderness. And then Joshua takes over from Moses, and Joshua takes him into the promised land. And God says to them, you are not like the neighbors. You are not like the Hittites or the Perizzites or the Philistines or anybody else. You're unique. Your distinctives are incredibly different. You are nothing like them. And yet I read the book we're about to go through, and I read a study in how the people of God begin to just melt into the neighborhood. And the people of God begin to lose the distinctive that is theirs and become like their neighbors. Not only do I watch it happen, I get to watch it happen over and over and over again. In fact, there's a cycle in the book of Judges, which is we become a people of distinctive and we know what it is. And then bit by bit, we just melt into the neighbors. And out of that comes real tragedy and brokenness, a real wickedness that happens. And we rediscover our distinctive again, and then we melt back in, and you watch it occur. If you want to know how to watch believers become ungodly and just melt into the culture of their neighborhoods, this book will show you how it happens. In fact, we've titled this book, How to Ruin Your Life, because this is the key theme in the middle of it. Let's jump in. Let's start back in the book of Judges, the book of Joshua. Joshua warns the nation that it can happen. In fact, not only does he warn it can happen, I think to read his language basically says, I realize it's going to happen. Joshua writes, as they take possession of the land, as they are a distinctive people, and he says, maintain that or hold that. Here's how he says it. Joshua 24, verse 14, rather classic passage. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods of your forefathers, the gods your forefathers worshipped before beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Verse 25, he draws up a covenant for them. Joshua made a covenant for the people, and he drew up for them decrees and laws. He put up a pile of rocks and said, may these pile of rocks stand to judge you, be as a witness against you if you're untrue to your God. Verse 27. So Joshua warns them, look, don't melt into the neighborhood. Whatever you do, don't melt into the neighborhood. And for a while they don't. Look at chapter 2 of the book of Judges. We sort of move our way into the book. Chapter 2. For a little while they don't. Verse 6, verse 7. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. And the people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So you have a portion of time where the children of God are distinctive and not incorporated and don't embrace the cultures around them. But you don't have to go far. In fact, we could find it in chapter 2, but I'm going to go to chapter 3 because it's so clear and painful and because I've spent all week learning the words. Verse 5 of chapter 3. And the Israelites lived among the Canaanites and Hittites and Amorites and Perizzites and Hivites and Jebusites. And they took their daughters in marriage, and they gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served other gods. And you can write in the margins, and they melted into the neighborhood. Jesus in John 17 gives a passionate plea. It's in a prayer. It's a plea to God. His plea to God is, God, please protect these disciples from the evil one. Well, what sort of things does he pray we'd be protected from? He mentions two things. One of them is this. Would these people understand they are in the world, but not of it? And this prayer, not to be of the world, don't let the people of God melt into their neighbors. Don't let it happen. You're going to find John writes passionately in 1 John. The Apostle John writes, in 1 John he says this, he said, the world's passing away, This world is experiencing the judgment of God and will experience the judgment of God. This world is decaying. It's on its way to the dump. And in that concept, he says, though, don't love the world. Don't love the world. Don't melt into the neighborhood. Don't choose the culture. Don't embrace the culture. And he uses language very similar back to the book of Genesis, where Eve saw the fruit and she saw it was good and it seemed appetizing to her. And John uses similar language to come back and say, don't. You look at the world the same way. It's a lie. It's false. Don't be absorbed into the culture. Paul writes some of his sadder words on a personal level. I wished I knew the full details of it, but you want to see a tragedy lived out? It's in 2 Timothy chapter 4, where Paul writes just a simple little verse about a guy named Demas. He says this, "And Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me." I don't know what that felt like, but here's a guy who said, "I'm no longer, to borrow this, I'm no longer German or Italian or anything else. I want to be like the neighbors." And he moved into that, whatever it was. The book of Hebrews warns throughout it. The book of Hebrews keeps saying over and over again this caution, this warning. Beware lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart and falling away from the living God. Well, where do you fall? Well, you fall in with your neighbors. Do you not understand the distinctive you are? Don't go there. The book of Revelation. When Jesus appears in all his glory and his power to the Apostle John, you think that the God of all creation would really want to straighten out the neighbors. He doesn't. He doesn't start with the neighbors. He starts with the church. There are seven churches. He starts talking to them. And the first one, he says this, "The church at Ephesus, I have this against you. You've lost your first love." Oh, what happened? You've started to love the same thing the neighbors love. You've melted in the neighborhood. The very last one is the church of Laodicea. He says, "I have this against you. You're not hot or cold. You're lukewarm. And I'm going to spew you out of my mouth." This concept in Scripture is don't melt into the neighborhood. It's over and over and over again. These things that we're studying in the book of Judges are not because we're going to study some ancient history just for our own curiosity. I study the book of Judges because the Scripture says, Randy, everything was written for your own instruction, that you might understand, that you might see, that you might not. Randy, don't melt into the neighborhood. Gang, you live in a culture that is not going to persecute you by the shedding of your blood. You are in a culture that's going to call you with a siren song, come join us, come be a part of us. And that issue is the issue the book of Judges is about. You'll always be absorbed in the neighborhood and the culture you're in if you forget who you are. We are citizens of the commonwealth of heaven. We are resident aliens. That's who we are. We are strange and odd people. That in itself is the very nature of our being. And to stop being strange and odd people, resident aliens, means we have compromised and been washed away. We are colony of the king. We are children not of this world. Our home literally is somewhere else. We're children of another kingdom. So how do we live that way? How do we keep from becoming worldly? How do we keep from embracing the culture? That's a big subject, and we'll take the entire book to talk some about that. But this morning, I want to pick up one concept, one significant idea we need to kick around. What will keep us from being absorbed in the culture? I want to begin with this, with something that won't work. There is zero protection for our children or our grandchildren in the practice of Christian ethics. You cannot protect your children or your grandchildren. You cannot protect your own life by the practice of Christian ethics. Stay with me a little bit. In the dictionary, the word ethics means accepted standards of right and wrong. It means a system of conduct. It means an appropriate lifestyle. So let me say again, there is no protection in the practice of Christian right and wrongs. There's no protection in the practice of Christian conduct. There is no protection in the practice of a Christian lifestyle that will protect your children and your grandchildren from being absorbed in the culture. And I hope at the moment you got it. Randy, are you wordsmithing and playing with words? Or I'm playing with concepts, not words. I'm not playing with words. I'm playing with concepts. Let's start with this. The Chinese wanted to protect their own nation from the barbarians and the invaders of the north, and so they built the Great Wall of China. That massive wall took about everything the culture could do. In fact, it almost taxed the entire nation into complete poverty and breakdown. But they built a wall, because if we could just build a wall, we'll keep those nasty barbarians north, and they won't be invading us where we are. Didn't work. Nasty barbarians still got in. Hadrian's Wall. The Romans built Hadrian's Wall in England because Hadrian's Wall will keep those nasty barbarians north where they belong. And we can live civilized, and now we want to live down here, and we're protected. And that wall will protect us. Christians have said, how do we protect our children? How do we protect our grandchildren? How do we keep from being absorbed into the culture? How do we keep from just being like the Irish, like the Germans, like the Swedes, or anything else? How do we keep from just being absorbed in? The answer is, we'll build a wall of Christian lifestyle and Christian ethics, and we'll all practice Christian lifestyle and Christian ethics, and that wall will be the buffer. That wall will hold the barbarians out, and they won't be able to get in, and our children will be safer at least. And so we have Christian dress and Christian customs and Christian traditions and family practices. We have language we use, a unique language we speak, words we use. Nobody uses the word blessings except a Christian. Hear an interview, we use that word. It's a technical language. We'll define our lifestyle with songs. And if we can just build a package of Christian ethics and Christian behavior, and we can live as a Christian people, we'll be protected. Oh, really? Oh, really? The Amish have said that. The Amish have said, look, let's take a particular year. Let's take that slice of a year, and all the world can move on, and we're going to hang on to that year, and we're going to have it as a buffer. And so our people are protected. We will live within this ethic and this lifestyle and this standard. The Mennonites have said, well, we don't agree with the year you chose, but we agree. So what we'll do is we'll dress all our people in black, and we'll drive black pickups, and we will milk by hand, and we'll protect our people, and we'll build a lifestyle. And we've said, oh, the Amish aren't right. The Mennonites aren't right. But we'll build our lifestyle. And so we've used the Republican Party. We've used James Dobson. We've used Focus on the Family. We've used all kinds of things. And we've said, we'll build a Christian worldview, a Christian ethic, a Christian system that will protect us. Did you ever watch Fiddler on the Roof? Poor old man pulling his hair out. Because he's got all these traditions that are meant to protect his children, meant to protect his family. There's a lifestyle that's theirs. And yet his kids just keep going around the lifestyle. They keep going around the traditions. And he can't figure out, how do you protect your family from being absorbed into the culture? I've done a lot of counseling with the Mennonites. I use them as an illustration, just like us. If we could just practice this lifestyle, it'd all turn out okay. The trouble is, their hearts are still broken because their children won't stay in it. Why is that? The answer is pretty clear in tradition, in Scripture. Our traditions have no power to protect. Our lifestyle is impotent against the neighbors. Judges chapter 2, verse 10 is a significant verse that starts the book. Judges chapter 2, verse 10. And after that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. You know what our only distinctive is? Our only distinctive is each one knows the Lord. Quite frankly, that is the only distinctive of the Christian life. They do not make such a thing as a Christian ethic or a Christian lifestyle that can be imparted or handed on to anybody else. There is no such thing. In fact, a Christian lifestyle or a Christian ethic is nothing more than my grandfather's clothes in some sense. You can give me my grandfather's clothes and I might understand them, but they're not mine. They don't fit me. And I could wear my grandfather's clothes for a little while, but it wouldn't be long before I will pitch them off. They're not me. The Christian distinctive is not our lifestyle. Our Christian distinctive is not our traditions. Our Christian distinctive is this: each one knows the Lord. And there arose a generation who did not know the Lord. Our only distinctive as a Christian colony, our only distinctive in life is that we have a relational response to Him, Him who is true, Him who is real, Him who is coming, He who sees with their own eyes. And the central and cultural rules we pass on to our children have no power to protect. It's like wearing somebody else's wedding ring. Wearing somebody else's wedding ring has no impact on you. It's like dressing in somebody else's clothes. It's theirs, it's not mine. I speak as a metaphor here, even more than a straight illustration, but my cousin Becky had a mother who was pretty strict in how Becky would dress. And I don't think Jean was out of line, her mom. I don't think she was wrong. But her mom would say, "Becky, you're not going to dress that way. You dress this way." And so Becky, the teenager, would dress the way her mom told her to dress. But I was farming the ground. They rented a house from the piece of property we had. And I would see Becky as she walked by the barn or something, go to her car. And I would say, "Oh, you're headed out," or whatever. And she said, "Yes, but not in these clothes." And she wore them out of the house. She wore them to her car. But in her car, she always kept an extra change of clothes. And she would drive the half mile down to the end of the driveway, and she would change clothes at the end of the driveway, and she would go where she was going to go. And when she would come back, she'd stop at the end of the driveway and come back the last half mile in the driveway in the clothes her mom sent her out, and Becky changed clothes in the process. Our culture has lived and watched Christians do that. The great plea is, why can't we hang on to our kids? We've given them our culture. We've given them our ethics. We've given them our lifestyle. Why is it not working? The answer is, when the heart of the individual is like the neighbor's, that I want to have a life of my own, I want to have my own place, I want to have respect, I want to have, when you have the same goals as the neighbor's, you can't keep. Oh, you'll still do Christmas Eve services, and you'll still love Easter, and you'll still read some Bible stories to your kids, and you'll still want to have your kids in church, and you'll still want to have a preacher, and you'll still want to get married in church. That's our distinctive now. Like having scones at holidays. But it's powerless to keep us from being the melting pot within the world. Judges chapter 17, verse 6. And Judges 21, verse 25, finish the book with the same theme. In fact, the very summary, if you want to, in some ways, of this entire book. Judges 17, verse 6, Judges 21, verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Don't you read that through secular eyes. That isn't referring to King Saul or King David, or that isn't referring to King Rehoboam or Jeroboam. That's not the issue. The issue is God was their king, and whenever a generation, whenever an individual forgot or discarded that God is my king, then all the lifestyle and all the traditions passed on were helpless to protect them from being melted into the culture. You see, our only distinctive is to follow Christ. So what words are you permitted to say and not say? What does the Christian ethic say? That's irrelevant. The only way I understand on how am I to live is I have to choose my words on what would the king's ears be pleased by. And what words does the king use? And because I live in a personal interchanged with the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There is no other Christian ethics. Nobody can say, hey, Christians wouldn't live that way. Now, wait a second. Wait a second. On what basis are you saying that? Are you saying that off the basis of the traditions and the structure we have built within the environment and the Christian culture we have? Or are you saying that in light of the relationship with the King of Kings and Lord of Lords? If you say it from one, it's powerless. It's neutered. If you say it from the other, it's incredibly powerful. It changes everything. How do we spend our money? What is the Christian ethic for spending money? Well, there isn't such a thing. Well, yeah, there is, because I bought books at the bookstore and there's a Christian ethic on my... No, there's not. No, there's not. Not in that sense. Not with a period at the end of that. The only place there's a Christian ethic is when I understand, God, it's all yours, and God, today I will live in your glory and your honor, and how do I spend it? It's in the interchange of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He who has a king has power in his life not to be integrated with the neighbors. He who has no king has no protection from the Christian lifestyle. Ethics cannot be separated from the relationship. There is no way. We're an outpost in a colony of heaven. And the way we live distinctive is because we're relational and I understand the end. And I never lose sight of the end. There's a lot of places in life that I feel peer pressure. I'm like the rest of you. I feel peer pressure in places. It's a funny thing. I have almost never felt peer pressure in an airport. Now, I've sat with people all around the room, and they're very different from me. I have never thought, but wow, I need to look more like that guy, dress like more like that. Airports, I have zero peer pressure. You want to know why? Because I know how incredibly temporary it is. I'm flying out here in 25 minutes. So why do I feel peer pressure to be like this guy in that chair or this one? There's zero peer pressure in an airport. Why? Because I understand I'm not home. Why be attracted by something so temporary? In a same sense, those who live as a Christian colony, as an alternative culture, they're the people who understand the relationship and live with an eye to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You want to protect your kids, the kids that are here? You can't put enough trappings of the Christian life. You can't put enough verbiage in the Christian life. You can't do enough. I'll send them to Christian schools. I'll homeschool. I'll. You can't do anything if your child doesn't choose the King. Everything else is just a charade if they don't choose the King. And if they choose the King, they don't need a Christian culture handed to them. To follow the voice of the King will be sufficient. That concept, you got to wrestle with. There's a second version of this, by the way. How do we keep them being melted into the neighborhood? Well, if we could just make the barbarians live a Christian lifestyle, that would help. Because they're too tempting the way they are now. They're sort of got the siren song. So if we could just make the barbarians live more of a Christian lifestyle, maybe our kids and our grandkids would toe the line better, and they wouldn't be as attracted to it. I believe much of the passion that I hear in our culture about our founding fathers and their faith, I think much of the passion has some legitimate good substance because we try to use it as teaching tools to help people discover the King. But to be real frank with you, another portion of our great passion about our founding fathers and their faith is misguided. It's misguided because here's what we're attempting to do. We're attempting to go, hey, you barbarians, you don't get to set the rules. Our forefathers predated you. They get to set the rules. The Monopoly game is going to be played under our rules. It's our rules. You understand us? We get the country back. We get the land back. We get the nation back. Play under our rules. Let's think that through a second. You're asking barbarians, people who don't have a king, to play by our rules because we were here first. Have you looked through at the nation of Israel Have you noticed whenever they were practicing their festivals, their new moon feasts, and they had all the cultural rules, did you notice in Isaiah and Jeremiah what God says to the people and what he says to the culture? If you have no king, the trappings are irrelevant. If you have no king, the trappings mean nothing. And tell me, how well has it been? How well has it gone to capture political culture of our country and make it Christian political? How well has it gone to capture pop culture in our country and make it Christian pop? How well has it gone to capture economic culture and make it Christian economics? The reality is, you cannot dress up barbarians in Christian clothing and Christian rules and somehow find it helpful. I had a great weakness early on. I don't mind telling you. In my teenage years, I saw this big gap between the Church of Jesus Christ that was loyal to Christ and the world. In this huge gap, I kept thinking, wow, if we just could find the right people who could speak both to the culture and to the church and the culture could be friends. They could get along better. If we just had the right celebrity who could stand in the gap. If we had the right politician who could stand in the gap. And I finally realized how misguided that was when I finally realized culture is always going to be at war with the colony of heaven. And the colony of heaven can never change the monopoly rules in such a way that the culture that's not of heaven can ever live under it. It's just, if you don't have the king, then all of the trappings are irrelevant. If you'll take a look at Europe, you'll see nation after nation where the government said, we're going to play by Christian rules. Have you seen those nations now? Have you seen their cathedrals? Go to Orthodox Russia, where the Orthodox Church said, you're going to play by Christian rules. Whether you have a king or not, you're going to play by Christian rules. Do you know what was the breeding ground for communism? Have you seen the Vatican? I'm not throwing rocks. I'm just speaking honestly. You cannot take Christian rules and impose them. Jerry Falwell and Randy Garris, we've been wrong at times because we were trying to build a wall that would help protect the saintly and the godly. There is no wall you can build other than this. Let every man serve his king. And the Christian who serves his king will always be unique and strange and odd and different and wonderful. Look at the church in the first century. The church in the first century simply existed as people who bowed their knee to the King of Kings, had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. They worshiped together because they all had the same king. And they went about doing good and radically changing the world, turned the world upside down because they knew the truth. The Church of Jesus Christ, when it flourishes, is when we understand you change hearts. And then you don't have to worry about the culture. And if you're not changing hearts, there's no culture to exchange. That issue is clear in Scripture. The Christian lifestyle upon a culture is like throwing pearls before swine. It's a phrase Jesus uses. Jesus says, don't throw your pearls before swine. Why do you not throw pearls before swine? Well, two people are going to be frustrated. You who threw the pearls, they don't get it. Well, I'm giving this great lifestyle. If you just live this way, it'd be better. They don't get it because they don't have the king. And I can also tell you this, the pig's frustrated because your pearls are worthless. Your pearls don't taste good, and your pearls don't look pretty to them, and your pearls don't mean anything. Christian culture given to people who don't have the king will not work. And so what's the job? We get to live as a strange, odd, wonderful people who have the king, who keep saying to one person at a time, you could have the king. You could have the king. A lifestyle without a covenant relationship is like a marriage without love. When I'm at my best, and I'm using an illustration, it's when I begin to process everything through the covenant relationship I have with my wife, Julie. I don't mind telling you, Julie has been such a joy and a privilege in my life. When I think how I'm going to spend my money, now I have the right to spend my money pretty well however I want to. I mean, I've got it in my billfold here, and I worked a good 15 hours last week for it. I have the right to spend it, and it's not like I have, I don't have an overbearing wife by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm at my best when every time I spend my money, I think in terms of us and our relationship, and how could I bless her with it, and what's the right thing to do in light of how her heart is. Boy, how I spend my money just raises a standard that's higher. When I think how I'm going to spend my time, if I will think, wow, my time needs to be invested always through the filter of what does my wife and how would it bless her and how would it impact her, it changes everything in how I spend my time. My life is sweeter and better. Things are much better when I do that. Now, because that's true for me, let me tell you what doesn't work. I can't stand in the aisles of Home Depot or Lowe's and announce to everybody who's standing there, hey, you guys, I wouldn't buy that. Have you considered what Julie thinks? Have you thought what Julie thinks about it? They would look at me a bit odd. And I could say, well, Julie's very wise. Serve me well what Julie has thought. But ultimately, they're not married to Julie. And they have no relationship with Julie. And so what Julie thinks is just a bit of clamoring of some odd guy in the middle of the aisle. We go to the checkout line, and somebody's buying beer. I go, hey, that's against Julie's rules. I want you to know that. Even if I say, Julie's rules. I mean, no matter how I say it, Julie's rules. It's irrelevant because there is no relationship with Julie. So how do we protect our children from being absorbed in the culture? The answer is not to build a Christian culture that insulates them. But to build a heart for the King is the only way. That's risky. That's scary. That's hard. And it'll break your heart because not all your kids will choose the King. But the only way not to be melted into the culture is the King. Do we ever get to leave this culture? Absolutely. We get to be separated from it. Not by buying an island in the South Seas. There'll come a day the Lord will split the sky open, and when He splits it open, He will say, come home. You dear aliens, come home. You colony of heaven, come home. And there'll be a day we come, but until that day, we live in the world, but we're not of it. And we're not of it because of a singular issue, the relationship with the King. I guess here's what I have to ask. So you tell me, who am I looking at? Am I looking at children of the King, or am I looking at cultural Christians? Am I looking at people who've learned the trappings and the vocabulary, the language and the dress? Am I just looking at individuals who have melted in, but you've kept your scones and you've kept your sweetbread? Or am I looking at somebody whose whole life is centered around this one issue, which then builds a whole lifestyle that's strong and vibrant? It's just yours. It doesn't belong to anybody else but yours. It's what's the heart of the King, and how do I live in it?